Welcome to the Biomedical Frontiers Podcast, where we explore pivotal research projects and disruptive innovations aimed at translating scientific advancements into tangible healthcare solutions. I'm your host, Dasha Tischler.
Imagine inventing some sort of material that you're going to put in the body of someone who is dying, and that material will cure that person.
Our bodies are just incredible, and the biology is incredibly complicated. The safety data required to ensure that no harm is done or as minimal harm is done as possible. Many layers of complexity, and takes a long time, takes a lot of capital to develop something.
A company, even just an early stage startup company, would have probably a chemist at the table, would probably have a translational science person at the table, as well as people whose job is to keep people safe and prevent unnecessary risk.
The newer the paradigm, the more groundbreaking it is. There may not be any models or any data out there that exists to ensure safety and ethical standards.
The risks continue to exist even sometimes until you go to market and the product's been in existence for a few years, really.
Once David and his teams feel like, okay, the science is landed, then the question that comes to me is, well, how do we then convince people who have a lot of money to pay for the next phase?
Today, we have two guests to discuss, debate, and share their vision for innovation in life sciences. They're working collaboratively here at UVA. Lisa Bowers, director of UVA's Enterprise Studio,
has extensive experience in biotech, Day One Bio, Dice Therapeutics, Roche, and Genentech.
Investor, a thought leader in healthcare and biotech innovation.
She once opened for Bon Jovi, a wife and a mother. David Chen, director of the Coulter Center, producer of the show.
Assistant Dean for Entrepreneurship and Innovation Partnerships.
Directs $32 million endowment. Helped found 30 new biomedical companies.
Professor of practice, practicing jujitsu brown belt under Gordon Emery, husband and father of three.
Lisa, David, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Hi.
Well, one of the things that we're going to be tackling in the next season of the show are big healthcare problems. And I think it's exciting to kind of end this season with a discussion of biomedical innovation, how it works in different areas of industry, academia, and how it can be used to address some of these very large systemic challenges. I would like to get from each of your perspectives, what are the layers of complexity that make solving healthcare challenges so difficult?
So, complexity is the middle name of healthcare, in my view. So the first place that I always start when I'm talking about why healthcare is hard is the economic reality of it, which is in most healthcare, the person who receives the benefit from whatever it is not the same person who makes the decision and is not the same person who pays. And as a kind of sofa economist, that's where I believe a whole lot of the challenges lie. You're also talking in healthcare about doing the impossible. I mean, imagine, you know, inventing some sort of material that you're going to put in the body of someone who is dying, and that material will cure that person. The complexity around this is phenomenal, not just about the economics and what it means for incentives, but how one thinks about actually making sure that it's safe, how we test it such that we're sure that not only is it safe, but it's efficacious, how we think about pricing something like that, that is actually saving lives, how we actually manufacture something like that at scale in a way that is safe and effective, how we work with large regulatory bodies across the entire globe, each of which has its own points of view about how they make decisions associated with health technology. I actually think the fact there is any healthcare device or medicine on the planet that is doing good is a miracle.
Yeah, you know, and I love what you're saying there, Lisa. I couldn't agree more. I also say just the fundamental science is complicated. Our bodies are just incredible, and the biology is incredibly complicated. And it's humbling just to think about just us being here, be able to sense one another, understand, create language, and be able to think through complex answers. And then when something happens, if there's a external agent like a virus or bacteria, or if there's something that goes wrong with our genetics, or something, a protein that goes awry, trying to correct that system is complicated. And so the research takes a long time. I know we'll be talking about that. And then the safety data required to ensure that no harm is done or as minimal harm is done as possible. And then, of course, you know, to your point also, you know, efficacy. And then payers, insurance companies, reimbursement, and then the data required to convince physicians that it's safe and effective. Yeah, many layers of complexity and takes a long time, takes a lot of capital to develop something.
When you're thinking about the process between kind of seeing a problem, really, before we even have a solution, just seeing something that really needs a new approach to solve it, maybe there's nothing, no cure, no treatment or alleviation, and then that solution, whether it's a technology and a product, or maybe even it's just a procedure or a different way of doing some sort of treatment, what are the biggest roadblocks that come up consistently to get something from we have a problem that needs a solution to we have a solution that's working and it's being used?
Yeah, I think I'll start with just the data required. So if a new idea or a new procedure is to be introduced, you know, and again, the onus of safety as well as effectiveness is important. And so often researchers or clinicians, caregivers need to take a step back before introducing something into a, you know, human being, right? And so you take a step back to animal models or data, if it's like digital data and silico data, and then start asking questions around, well, how good is this data? Is this data, was it collected in a meaningful way, you know, to this new paradigm, this new technology, right? Oh, well, it wasn't really collected with the intent for this new procedure, this new paradigm. And so it's like, well, we need to collect the data then. And so then you might take a step further back into, you know, cellular models or smaller animal models. And of course, doing all this under the auspices of ethics and proper guidelines and principles, we don't want to needlessly cause suffering to any living thing. And so you're often taking these steps back and back into, you know, experimental models, and maybe there's not an appropriate model for that research study, and then you need to make that model. So it gets a bit long, and a lot of it comes down to, you know, not causing harm, not causing needless suffering, in order to show that this idea, this concept is efficacious. And the newer, I guess I'll say one last thing, the newer the paradigm, the more groundbreaking it is, the less likely, I mean, this has not empirically been shown, but there may not be any models or any data out there that exists to ensure safety and ethical standards. So those are some of the reasons why it's complicated.
I will also say that this is why David and I are such a great partnership, because his space of working is the dialing back. Right? Like, what is true about the science? What has to be true about the science, not about what you thought was true yesterday, but what we now want to run at. And then once David feels like, and his teams feel like, okay, the science is landed, then the question that comes to me is, well, how do we then convince people who have a lot of money to pay for the next phase? Right? Like, this, the next obstacle is recruiting support and capital to pay for the scale and the like broader testing of the science that David just described that needs to dial back and back and back.
Yeah, and one of the things that also comes to my mind, thinking about things like holistic medicine, a lot of things that exist in our body can perform multiple functions in different parts of the body. I think, you know, neurotransmitters and hormones are great examples that have so many functions. Each one of them can be doing many different things at different times of the day in different parts of your body. And so, David, per your piece of it, scaling back to the right model, but also there's always this additional risk where you could be having expertise in a particular area, and it could be something that has potential for solving one piece of your, you know, a problem in the body, but actually have the wrong effect in a different part of the body. And there might be not a way to control that. So there's this inherent, I think, risk of discovery, even I think at later stages of development, sometimes you can discover things that are unexpected. And because of that, it's inherently risky, and that affects the funding piece as well, because unlike many other products that you might develop, you know, the MVP stage doesn't really expose you to all the risks. The risks continue to exist even sometimes until you go to market and the product's been in existence for a few years, really. you still have some level of risk. So how do we balance this sort of importance of these having these technological breakthroughs, but then this complexity of the system and the need for there to be some option for experimentation and risk taking, but also not doing any harm in such a way that technology moves through, right? Because like you said, Lisa, it's kind of miraculous that we get these technologies given the complexity. So what's required to make that, to strike that balance at different stages of product development and idea development? David, maybe starting with you because you start at the earliest stages.
David, what's involved in the mine for this?
I mean, I think one of the elements I love about University of Virginia, it is a very collaborative research environment. And so we have these researchers who are, you know, experts in their specific domain areas, you know, biomaterials or medical imaging or therapeutic ultrasound, all these areas that are very, very hyper-focused, guests that you've had on the podcast over the last two seasons. They have this world expertise in these little areas, but then needing data or understanding models in other areas, right? They can work with one another. They can connect, you know, also outside the region to other universities and collaborators to share their information, share their data. I think that's one of the elements of, you know, academic scholarship and peer review, of sharing the data, sharing the models to the best way possible to help advance that knowledge, because the problems get very complicated and sort of irreducibly complicated, but then you need to step back, right, and ask a data scientist or ask an imaging expert or ask a materials expert, you know, advice and how to think through models, how to think through the chemistry or the biology. And I think that's one of the great things about biomedical engineering is that it is a field of many subfields. But as a result, you can have a lot of great interdisciplinary collaboration and natural collaboration across many clinical areas and technical spaces.
And I'll add to that to just say, once it gets out of UVA, the same holds true, right? There is no biotech or biomedical company that doesn't have lots of people sitting around the table all trying to solve the problem through their technical expertise. So a company, even just an early stage startup company, would have probably a chemist at the table, would probably have a translational science person at the table, might have a clinical person like a physician at the table to assess things, as well as people who understand what the rules and regulations are for our regulators. Whose job is to keep people safe and prevent unnecessary risk. So that's one thing, is that cross-functional work continues. And the larger the company, the more complicated it is. But to me, that's where the real magic happens. And then in the other answer to your question is, you know, the current system that's in place in order to get at least a therapeutic approved requires appropriate testing. And I don't know, Dasha, if you and your listeners have talked about the general drug development path already on your episodes. No. So there are three phases of development that usually the FDA requires before approving a drug. And the first phase one is entirely about safety, to your point. Usually it's a very, very, very small group. And this is after all the animal testing, after all the modeling, after all the things that David just described. The very first time we put it in humans, all we're doing is testing to see if the humans survive it. And very, 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 seeking very, very, very weak signals related to how the body metabolizes things and how the different systems respond. So there's an incredibly robust amount of testing that happens in order to assess whether there are unintended consequences, like you just described, in phase one. And then in phase two, that's the next phase where you get to say, if we expand the number of people, is it still just as safe, or do we get any weak signals? And are we starting to see efficacy? Are we starting to see that we're solving the clinical problem that we intend to solve? And then phase three, generally speaking, is at scale. Now, not every product has to go through all three phases, and there are people who are experts in figuring out how to collapse and blend and meld those phases in order to get medicines to sick people as quickly as they can. But that system, and having people who understand that system and who are respectful of the dignity of the purpose of that system, is another important tool just for our society to ensure that risk is as minimized as it possibly can be.
It's interesting. One of the themes I hear actually both of you describing, on top of collaboration, is actually data, is one of the things that becomes so critical. Getting the right data to start with, finding the people who maybe have collected it, validating that it's good data, that it's true, and then in the later stages, it's gathering the, like, for safety, you said small signals. That sounds like you have to have selected the right data, enough of the data, but a lot of data is also confusing and can create the wrong signal, and so data's playing a huge role for this. What are you seeing in terms of transformations that are happening that are potentially supporting or maybe hindering innovation in biotech? Because I think data is a big conversation that we're having in the AI space, in sharing of data, cybersecurity, all of that is data, data, data.
Sure. So, you know, in my experience, so I've been in the industry, I'm no longer in the industry, but when I was in the industry, I was in it for several decades. Now I'm at UVA. A lot has changed. So certainly, like, big data allows us to better predict what we think is going to happen in trials, right? So the companies that have looked at, that have been able to get their hands on proxy information to help them design, the biostatisticians to design exactly what it is that they're building, is huge. So big data has been an enormous impact, I think, on drug development. Global collaboration has been had an enormous impact on drug development. So the ability, for example, to run clinical trials in countries all over the world in partnership with those regulatory authorities, also absolutely fabulous. I think also one of the most exciting things that I've seen from an innovation perspective is the industry, which has historic, and I come from kind of pharma and biotech, historically, we in that industry are super interested in, you know, the bigger the market, the better. So there's a lot of medicines in diabetes. There's a lot of medicines in cardiovascular disease. Over the last 10 years, that has actually shifted to an ability to be interested in rare disease and orphan indications. And regulatory officials have been working collaboratively with companies, small, medium, and large-sized companies, to figure out how to speed up rare disease trials. So, for example, if you have, if you're trying to, you know, solve for a problem that only 500 people in the country have, that has implications for how you design the clinical trial and what the hurdles are that you need to get through versus the entire population of people who have diabetes in the United States. So I think there's been regulatory advances. I think there's been big data advances. And I think the kind of globalization of the business has also provided some acceleration that is really quite beautiful to see.
Yeah, and I'll just add briefly, you know, on the trial design, you know, there's a lot of talk and implementation of digital twins for more efficient trial, you know, implementation. Clinical trials are very expensive. They have to be run at a high level. They should always be run at a high level and safe and well well designed, and a lot of funding is put towards that. And so ways to make more efficient the trial enrollment, ways to change the trial design depending on the therapeutic indication. And I think digital twins and having, you know, data, longitudinal data, which is one of the big challenges, is not just data in this point of therapy, but data before the therapy, data after the therapy, you know, well-designed data gathering. And then, you know, way up early stage, Tom Barker, who's a co-instructor with me, and he's got a couple of startup companies, faculty here at UVA. But, you know, we have we're using AlphaFold for in class. So this is a, you know, out of DeepMind. it's really neat for the students to be able to interact with different proteins. And then, you know, this is a class exercise, but companies for sure use this to design therapeutic targets. Tom and I were just, you know, we'll sort of discuss how much it's changed the last 4 years, right? 3 or 4 years ago, students would use databases and kind of have these like peptide sequences. It wasn't the most terribly engaging, you know, exercise, but now they can take AlphaFold and then import it into some visualization software and see like protein structures. Now, these are sort of computational models, so they may not be perfect. We don't really, you know, it's hard to see how these look like. They're really small. But it definitely creates a more engaging way to think about therapeutic drug design. And for sure, companies are using these types of tools to design therapeutics and create math models and then complex shapes. So data is important.
One of the things that it kind of raises a question for me, especially for the audience, part of our audience that's maybe still in school, do you have to be getting deeper into science now in order to be making more impact? Or is it actually different? Like it's more about working with data and different tools. From the things we've heard on this podcast, we've seen how much impact having like a PhD and doing research for many years has. But we're also hearing like modeling used to be this extremely complex exercise. And now there's tools that are pretty much visual and people can learn it in a day and start building systems and experimenting and building experiments on the fly rather than, you know, spending like 3 weeks training just to how to set it up a model or something like that.
I mean, I guess I'll briefly answer that. In the class that Tom and I teach, we have, you know, juniors and seniors, third and fourth year BME students, very bright. But we have a number of students that come from other parts of the university. And I think these new tools make it a little more approachable. I'm not necessarily saying they are ready to dive in and be experts in it, but I think if we can capture the imagination of a student and a learner, I think that's the part of the power of these models is capturing that imagination. It doesn't seem as so far away, like some super technical, highly trained person in some dark corner who does that work. It can be all types of citizen scientists. And I tend to believe talent is everywhere, and it's about putting the right tools and the right training and inspiring that person, that talented person to take that step forward. And so there's definitely a lot of opportunity there in opening up these very, very complex science questions to more people.
Well, Lisa, I want to turn to digging into this incredibly long time that you have been forging partnerships, working both private sector, entrepreneurs, being an investor even. One big question is sort of, okay, when we're translating these ideas out of science and into the world, creating companies, what are some unusual players? Who needs to be brought to the table to help this? Because it sounds like a really big team effort. Should health systems and insurers be participating more in this process? Or where are you seeing a potential for partnerships?
Partnerships in early stage development, is that the question?
And translation out of early stage development into commercialization.
Sure. So, you know, to be honest, this may not be the answer that you want, Dasha, but I actually don't think you want 5,000 people in a room trying to make decisions about stuff that is this hard. Like, I'm an actual believer in teams of people who are accountable and single decision maker models. And the reason I say that is because I know that I think that large groups can certainly provide lots of good brainstorming ideas, but your viewers can't see me do this, but do you guys know about the diamond? Like basically large groups and lots of people at the table will allow your ideas to expand and allow you to basically have a volume of good thinking. But eventually people need to come to the narrow point of a diamond and say, like, who are the three people who are on the hook for making good decisions or holding the fact that the decisions that were made were not good. So I say that to say, you know, I have been involved in lots of kind of consortia groups of people trying to solve big systemic problems. And I think that those are great for idea generation, but not for actually running a company. It's just not my game. But that said, but let me then answer your question in another way, which is, I think there is a lot of small biotech and medical device companies that think that all they need on their initial staff is like the head scientist and a guy who can raise money, and that everything else kind of doesn't matter that much. To your question, I actually think that the more cross-functional the experts are in a room, a small group of experts, a group of experts that's held accountable for the outcomes that they're driving, that actually creates more insight. So for example, I'm going to talk a little bit about Tom Barker again. Hopefully he'll listen to this and know how much we adore him.
We'll just have to bring him onto the podcast.
I mean, you really should, because Tom is right now thinking about, Tom is, as David said, a faculty member at UVA. he's already running a company and he's thinking about another one. And I won't divulge too much information about that. But Tom came to me and said, I want to run this company faster and harder than I've ever done anything in my life. What's the best way to do that? And I was like, well, Tom, to do that, let's get some brains on this that you would otherwise wait for 3 years to get on it. Like someone who understands right now how the FDA is going to think about this. Like, let's get you a regulatory expert immediately. Let's try to understand how physicians are making decisions immediately. Let's figure out what payers, to your point, Tasha, what health insurers are going to believe is appropriate from a pricing perspective right now. That doesn't mean that all those things are going to be true 5 years from now when you're ready to go, but just getting the founder's brain wrapped around the fact that he has more stakeholders than just the publication that's going to come out of this thing, like people who can tell him what the FDA will say, people who can tell him what United Healthcare will say, people who can tell him what the nurses might say or the patient's parents might say, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I would say I don't want lots and lots and lots of institutional players around trying to solve a really hard problems. I'd love their ideas from a brainstorming perspective, but then I want to get the founders exposed to the right group of experts who can help inform their early stage decisions. Does that answer your question?
That's a beautiful answer to the question.
Thank you.
It's nuanced and it's like, where's the balance fit?
Yeah,
I love it.
That's right. It's not that it takes one person in a room. One person in a room cannot solve the unsolvable. But I also believe that 100 people talking and feeling good about themselves also does not solve the unsolvable. I think it's a group of people who are looking in each other's eyes and saying, are we going to do this? And are we going to hold all the good and bad decisions in front of us? That's what I think this involves.
Yeah, I like that. David, I know that you also have to get some of these questions answered or try to get them answered even before technologies that are funded by Coulter leave the door as startups or maybe partnerships or licensing. What are sort of your ideas around, the things that people really need to be thinking of earlier and people they need to bring to the table?
Yeah, and I like Lisa's answer. I guess the question, I don't know, maybe this is not a good idea. I believe in what Lisa's saying, and I think that is the right way to do it. It's always a I think in my back of my head is like, how do you scale that? How do you, because it's concierge-like, which is great, but then there's Tom, but then there's other people as well. And maybe it's not scalable. Maybe that these are very sort of singular cases. And I guess I can't help but think that sometimes sort of with my more institutional hat of like, 185 faculty and engineering is working one-on-one with every single let's say half of them are interested in entrepreneurship. So working with 90-ish seems like a lot to be able to put teams around each in very, very different domain areas. And so maybe like to answer your question, Dasha, and we can definitely revisit that, what I just put out there, is I think in some ways, and I'm not saying the science is easy, it's not, but thinking through what science or what data is needed in order to get this technology closer to adoption, closer to a product, closer to the market or clinical adoption, right? And so sort of taking that, and I think that's a hard thing to do. I think what Lisa is tackling is a lot of players. It's very, very complex. I don't know. I just put a lot out there. I'm not sure that was...
Oh, can I respond? Because I totally agree. So the beautiful news for your listeners who are like, oh my gosh, so I have to personally go and find... I'm about to graduate from the BME department at UVA. I don't know anybody that knows any of these things at all. How am I supposed to move forward? Well, the good news is you have the Enterprise Studio, right? You have people around you who can help connect you to those types of people. And the other thing is, and this may be, stop me if this is obvious, but I'm going to articulate it nonetheless. There are little shops of people who only think about the FDA all the time. And little shops of people who only think about private payers and Medicare, and little shops of people who only think about how people have been pricing drugs for the last 20 years, or who think about safety design, or who think about how to manufacture. Actually, and those people have seen all of the other companies that have come before you. So that, David, is the efficient way. I don't think we need to build little full-time teams around all of these people. I think the dream, and I actually... this maybe answers a previous question that you had, Dasha. I have talked to several people over the last couple of years that are trying to build like virtual gig economy biotech companies. Like, you know, can we get like experts in this and have them move in and out? Now, the truth is a large corporation does that. Like full-time only people who think about contracting with health insurance companies and full-time only people who think about quality for small molecule creation in a factory, right? A big corporation has these kinds of centers of excellence that are functional experts that can move across multiple business units or multiple products. But the world outside of the corporation also has those kinds of services. So I would stress for your listeners that, yes, you need the cross-functional expertise. Yes, you need to get people around you, I think, earlier rather than later, that are more than just thinking about the science. But you don't have to know them personally yourself, and you don't have to hire them with the little tiny bits of money that you have.
Well, you introduce a great topic, Lisa, which is Enterprise Studio and how it relates to all of these discussions of technology transfer, people with ideas, people who want to solve big challenges. And so maybe we can use this as also an introduction to what Enterprise Studio, what are you building and how does it relate to this big vision of how things could translate?
So the Enterprise Studio was just created on January 2nd when I was hired. So we are incredibly new. And the hypothesis that it's intended to test is that there's a need at UVA for basically a service, a support service for faculty and graduate students who themselves are thinking about, hey, I have some science and David Chen tells me it's pretty good. Now, what do I do?
That's scary. Okay.
I know. But like, that's what I think is actually happening in the world, right? Like they've gone back. They've modeled. They've tested. Now what? Now, you know, we do have lots of resources here in Charlottesville, as well as at UVA specifically, to support those idea generators. I'm not even calling them founders yet. The idea generators who are like, I've just invented this thing. I think it's actually a real invention. What happens next? Those people are not yet ready for what we would call venture funding, right? They can't go out and get someone to give them $1 million. They're not ready to jump into something. They don't even know that they want it to be a company. The studio is meant to fill that gap. So I sit kind of between all the people that David is talking to about modeling and, for example, the LVG Seed Fund, whose function is to say, oh, now you've decided to start a company. Maybe I'll fund you. Or there are other venture funders that could help you out. So we're in that little gray space where our job is to encourage, not assess. We're not here to tell you whether you're going to make $1 billion or whether you're going to cure this incurable disease. We're here to say, we hear you have an idea. Let's talk through how to understand whether that idea could have impact in the world and match you with some advisors, match you with some resources, maybe help you with a little bit of education about what the process of creating a company might entail, and then send you off, triage you to a number of different types of organizations around. Like, for example, for the BME shop, you know, the Commonwealth Bio Accelerator that is being stood up right now by Seville Biohub is a great partner to the studio, because after people come and hang out with us for a while, they say, we want to build a company, but we need a bench. They can go and be part of that accelerator, or they could go and get financing from the seed fund here at UVA, or any number of different folks that are ready to catch them once they've decided to jump.
So Lisa, this kind of brings up an interesting question. And David, you have a lot of experience with this, specifically with the Coulter, not just providing money, but also providing program management. I hear you describe that the thing that really helps kind of go from ideation and good concept in a more general way, outside of just biotech, but also other areas of technology or even ideas that maybe aren't technological, is having kind of a combination of process, mentorship, and then I also hear like resources you get pointed to that are appropriate for whatever you're looking for. Is that kind of the thing, or is there something else on top of it, or am I missing something from what you're describing? And then would also love to hear, David, how does that work within the Coulter Center? Is it the same kind of blueprint or a different one?
I would say the way you described it makes a lot of sense. It's helping people figure out what the roadmap is to go from A to B, from I have an idea to I think I'm ready to start something. Mentorship and advising for sure, and resources. But I think resources, the question for me that we're currently in discovery about right now is what are the resources that each different school at UVA requires? So for example, what David at the engineering school and all of his faculty might require is quite different, for example, than what the architecture school might need or the School of Data Sciences, for example, or the School of Medicine. So we're right now thinking about how do we curate uniquely the right package of support for the kinds of faculty that are coming out of different schools at UVA.
Again, I'm really excited with Lisa joining and Enterprise Studio. And I think one of the opportunity areas is, you know, faculty, you know, full faculty, professor, associate professor, assistant professor, also, you know, teaching faculty, we call them academic general faculty. They have many responsibilities. There's the research responsibilities, right? Writing grants, publishing, sharing their work. There's teaching and mentoring. So it could be teaching a class, or it could be mentoring a graduate student or a postdoc. And then there's service to the institution. So service is serving on committees, enacting new policies. There's all sorts of service opportunities. And you know, these are the general sort of way that work is distributed across these different buckets. And there's actually percentages that faculty, you know, when we sign our contracts, like that we need to sort of fill. So then entrepreneurship or translational research could probably be on the research category, but it's not sort of often counted. It is now in the School of Engineering, to the credit of Dean West and Brian Smith and others, but not all the schools across the institution or even at large in other places count translational impact like intellectual property, startup companies, product development towards like these sort of like metrics. And so faculty have small slivers of time where they can think about translation. And I think that's where Lisa's work is so important. It's really like a force multiplier on the little sliver of percent effort of energy a faculty can put towards translating their software or their material or whatever therapeutic agent. And so now they have a couple hours or a couple hours, let's say a week, to think about this and connecting with Enterprise Studio, having students connect with Enterprise Studio really can make, graduate students connect with Enterprise Studio can make a really, really big difference. The Coulter Center, we do fund translational research and projects, and that research can sometimes still have research impact in terms of publication or, you know, different sort of granting agencies to help sustain a lab. And so we sort of can cross both of those areas where there's a translational goal for a project, but it can also have, you know, I would say general science impact as well. And I think we're happy about that. In fact, I think it's great that some of our projects have tremendous impact in a field and defining new areas of research, but also have like a new product developed. And I know you had Sylvia on the podcast, season one. She's a great example, and her team, Craig Meyer as well, and Joe Hart of, you know, researchers who are interested in fundamental questions and how things work, but also have a new company or have a company and be able to help patients.
David, to your point, actually, one of the things that we've spent a lot of time talking about with this nascent studio team is we believe that the product of the studio is actually the people that come in, because we can help them see what the path might look like and help them weigh the kinds of choices they may need to make. I've seen so many grad students come in and be like, well, do I want to go in academia, or do I want to create a company based on my dissertation work? You know, or faculty that are like, I think I want this company to go, but I don't want to leave my tenured position. And so what does that mean? So we're also able to like say, well, what do you want your life to be? How do you think about maybe solving for this in creative ways? You don't have to leave your tenured position to have this company live. You might not be able to work in it full time, right? So part of that is helping each individual navigate the complexity of what it means to design a life that involves a university and or a startup enterprise.
Yeah, and I think that's like, I know we were sharing some like UVA policies, you know, around this. And often my role is to help navigate the different policies related to, you know, startup companies or translation and things. And I do think that a lot of what we do, whether respectively, where my role is more within a school and helping interpret like school priorities and goals and helping faculty understand that as they're thinking about translation. And, you know, you can sort of think through sort of larger institutional, but also like commercial. And I think we should have these conversations. Faculty should have these conversations. And then students benefit from this as well, because they can see sort of different ways to apply their training, you know, outside of the university environment.
As you're building Enterprise Studio, and then David, you've already gotten to see some of the impact of Coulter Center over the years. You know, there are many different criticisms out there and debates right now around policy. And one of the things that comes up is like universities have become these behemoths that do all kinds of things that isn't teaching or research, right? They've got the, you know, massive endowments, and they've got policy advocacy, and they've got country clubs and whatever, right? And these are very reasonable concerns. And also, I think it goes back to just a more fundamental question, which is like university, like the world has changed, right? So much. And there's so much, you know, both digital technologies, how people move, how global everything has become, how international even each of us has become individually and connected with people globally, that it makes sense that there would be transformation in the education system as well. A critique, particularly of doing like entrepreneurship within a university setting, can be that it's a distraction or it creates conflicts of interest. But I think it's also important to understand what the benefits can be when you have entrepreneurial faculty or graduate students that are given options for how to apply their theoretical or academic backgrounds into non-academic settings. And I'd like to kind of discuss that a little bit in terms of how does that change education? What are the benefits? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'll say simply that when, you know, if there's an opportunity for faculty to take their research and have it be applied and help, advance healthcare, cure a disease, you know, make energy more efficient or more effective, that's powerful for them individually. I think it's also very impactful to societal goals of reducing waste, increasing health. I think those are things that people generally want, is, cleaner, cheaper energy in all types of forms, and better health, more affordable, cheaper. As faculty pursue these, I think they are able to then train the future generations in how to pursue different ways to apply their knowledge. Students can pursue additional education, be researchers themselves. And in engineering, I think many of the students want to find ways to take that knowledge and solve problems, apply that knowledge and make the world a better place. So I think fundamentally, faculty that engage, and engage is a broad word. It can be engaging fully, I would say more often than not. It's engaging in a, partial part of their time towards these efforts. That provides a great learning environment for graduate students. Those faculty and graduate students can then teach undergraduates. We also do a lot of outreach to area public schools and high schools, and being able to introduce them to engineering principles and help them find ways of applying, their future training to solving, hard and tractable problems is, I believe, where sort of advancement comes from.
I agree, David. So of course, I'm going to say I think it's important because it's my job, but I actually have two sides of the coin. So first, I'll talk about why I think it's important. One is UVA itself is an economic driver of our community. And we're going to send people out to do all kinds of things, and sending people out who also understand how they might start companies, particularly in the state of Virginia, has tremendous value. Just right on the line. I think the other thing that I've thought through, I have a colleague named Brian Breslin who runs something called the Foundry at UVA. And Brian's job is, so I focus on grad students and faculty. Brian focuses on undergrads. And Brian's not there to spin a million companies out of the Foundry. He's there to actually show college students an alternative path and help them understand an entrepreneurial mindset that they can use to solve all kinds of problems in the world, even if they leave UVA and work for a 400-year-old law firm, or they go into grad school in English literature, Right. So the mindset, I think, is valuable. And by mindset, I mean a mindset of curiosity, a mindset of creativity, a can-do belief that you too can make an impact, an open-mindedness to hearing the beliefs of others as you're thinking about designing whatever you've been tasked to do, as well as the economic impact, generally speaking, for our community is dramatic. And I would imagine that would be the same for all universities. And there's so many other things, but I'll stop with those two things. But I will say the following. And if anybody listens to this, who's any of my recent doctoral student company founders, they will tell you this is true. The first thing I ask them when I sit down with them is, how are you doing on your dissertation? Because I care more about that than I care about what we're about to talk about. And if you need this hour to go finish your dissertation, go do that. Like, I think we also need to understand why the university exists, which is to generate. We need to give people degrees. We need to give people degrees that will help them be leaders in the world and do beautiful things. And I believe that education comes first and the entrepreneurishness comes second. And I think all of us that have the privilege to be holding this little precious space in the broader institution must hold true to that every single day. I will never suggest someone walks away from their undergrad degree. Well, those aren't the folks who are coming into the studio, but I'll never suggest that a grad student walks away from their core purpose. And I will never suggest that a faculty member use time that should be spent with students or should be spent with research, which is what they're paid to do here at UVA, to do anything but that. And the key is to be able to figure out how to run the core business and do those things. And the example that I'll give, and you can't do that when you're a startup, like the three people who are trying to figure out how to invent a thing, that's a full-time job and you shouldn't be casting around with broader ideas. But in a large institution, like this, I feel like it behooves us to be thinking more broadly than our core mission. And the example that I'll give you is, I was at Genentech and Roche for a really long time. And after a period of time, I kind of got good at the jobs I was doing. I knew how to run these big parts of the company. And I had an advisor say to me, like, hey, now your job is to go and figure out what the special projects are that you want to do that'll basically solve for problems that are not being looked at the company. One would argue that those are not the core businesses of selling as much medicine as you can in the United States to drive R&D for a major pharmaceutical company. But I worked at a company that understood my passion toward mission orientation and sort of public health and social good. And they allowed me to, as long as I could get my day job done, think about these other things. And that to me was basically one of the most beautiful things about my career there. And I will always be grateful to them for that. I think UVA is the same kind of world-class, large platform institution that has to have some capacity for people to follow their dream and get the core job done.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And the economic impact, as well as, you know, many students who are looking for role models who have maybe a more of a business or commercial aspect to it. And then also the exploration that happens when you try to translate ideas from, okay, we've proved something in science, but how do you make it work with everybody involved? Like, how does a physician make use of it? Those are all really, really great reasons. I want to switch the topic a little bit, going back into biotech a little bit more. But both of you are working with researchers, faculty, students who are coming from a variety of disciplines, but not just BME. And I'm wondering if you're seeing disciplines outside of traditional biomedical engineering department where there's a lot of opportunity to create impact on healthcare. Maybe ones that people don't traditionally think like, oh, I could be contributing to healthcare. But what you're seeing is actually there's a lot.
Ooh, can I do that one
Go
first?
Go ahead, Lisa. You're nodding. I love it.
Okay. So first, everyone listening needs to know I'm an English major and I'm not a scientist. And I don't even pretend to be one. Like, I don't actually, that's not my game. So that might mean no one will come to the Enterprise Studio because they'll be like, she's not a scientist. But so much about changing healthcare has nothing to do with the biology, right? Like, So, you know, I was an English major. This doesn't mean that I did this, but, you know, I just talked last week to a woman who does continuing medical education for physicians across every possible therapeutic area. She's a writer and an editor. Economists, as you remember, I talked earlier in the discussion about how I think actually economics are what drives most decisions in the healthcare field. Economists are huge in healthcare. Sociologists who study how people pick up behaviors or don't pick up behaviors. Are you a smoker or not? If you're not, it's probably because a social scientist thought about how to communicate that smoking is, guess what, not great for you. We need politicians to understand the value of what the healthcare system is and is not delivering. Right. We need teachers to be able to train people on how to think about even reading data, statisticians, right? Like, how do I know whether this thing is going to help my mother has breast cancer. She's being offered this treatment. It only works for 30% of people. What does that even mean? I actually think every single job in the world exists somewhere in healthcare. Right? Patient advocates, activists who want to drive change in the healthcare system and want to create access for people who otherwise don't have it. Anyway, I could go on and on, but the point is, if you care about the public's health, you can major in anything and get any graduate degree in the world and have a great career in healthcare. That's my statement. I wonder if anyone will call me and be like, but what about, you know, rocket science? I'll say, no, astronauts they do scientific studies associated with health in space. Those two.
It's true. They do. Actually, there's projects and food packaging and drug
everything.
Packaging into space and
everything. You pick it, you know, media, you want to make movies? Teach people about the importance of making sure they wear bike helmets. Like, there are all kinds of ways to impact healthcare any job.
And I think, like, media, of course, we're here doing a podcast, but I think that the way media has changed the last decade, it's so important to engage with creators, English majors, anthropologists on media creation and movies and snippets, because the way data is consumed now, there's just so many different ways, right? And so short snippets and pieces of information. I know, Dasha, you and I are talking about ways to sort of increase engagement, you know, using certain, you know, platforms. But, you know, being the more STEM-oriented person, I definitely am biased towards, you know, we talked earlier about data. And understanding complex data structures. Sometimes you do need pure mathematicians and computer scientists, mm-hmm. of course, data scientists and statisticians. And then I do see crossover on, like, traditional material science areas where being able to describe a material in sort of numerical engineering terms and translate that into human physiology is where there's a lot of neat crossover between the biomedical engineers, mechanical engineers, and material scientists, because BMEs and the way they're often trained with a lot of physiology, a lot of understanding human organ systems, and then working with a material scientist who really understands how to describe materials in very, very specific, you know, numerical terms. There's some really, really neat crossover around that space, and biomaterials is an area that you know, UVA really excels in. So I see a lot of crossover in those areas. And then, you know, again, on math and data in engineering, electrical engineering, signal processing on the medical imaging side, right? A lot of advances on MRI, MRI data capture, as well as processing. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of areas that are outside of the traditional biology, biochem, BME, molecular science, you know, bioscience spaces that there's great crossover. And I see that in students who come from different backgrounds, who want to train in biomedical engineering or have sort of dual appointments, as we call them, like their home department might be chemical engineering or material science, but then their faculty advisor or their advising committee might come out of sort of other areas, including BME. And I think that also captures both the strength and diversity of university ecosystems, where sometimes these intractable, very hard, big systemic problems, sometimes you do need, like, that deep crossover to try to tackle you know, these big problems. And it is inefficient. It can be very inefficient, take a long time. And I know that's it's frustrating for all of us. We would love to cure cancer and all sorts of diseases. I think that's safe to say. We would love to take away all diseases in the world, but there's just not enough information out there yet. We don't know.
Yeah, well, as you're looking across kind of the things that people are coming up with now as solutions, are there any emerging trends that you're noticing or things that maybe people aren't paying attention to that should be trends in terms of healthcare impact for the coming 5-10 years?
Well, that's a big question. Lisa, do you want to take that first?
I'm scratching my head. I mean, my honest answer is I see lots of really cool ideas that are coming out of this university and they inspire me every day. But what's exciting is that I don't see themes. I don't see themes. It is a random scatterplot of awesome is kind of what I see from UVA, which is where my brain's been for the last couple years. As I said, you know, the stuff that I've seen at a more kind of global scale or, you know, use of blockchain and how that's going to change in the way that we deliver healthcare, use of gig economy models and how that's going to change healthcare, AI, right? And how AI is basically going to inform us about the outcomes of trials before we even run them is going to change healthcare. But in my daily life, it's just amazing, earnest, creative people coming in and saying, here's something you've never thought about, Lisa. And I think about it all the time. And I want to know what I can do with it. So not as many patterns, just more like bright points of light.
Maybe if we, you know, in terms of 10 to maybe 10 to 15 or beyond 10 years, you know, I think next, you know, quantum computing, I do think is coming around the corner way faster than people realize as, you know, these new computational models demand more computing power and more efficiency. I mean, I know that there's some companies now that are changing that paradigm, but I do think that computational power will, you know, increase in demand. And so I really do think that will open up new opportunities for new materials, new paradigms for computing, and then also like more efficient energy models, because more computational power requires often, you know, more energy, and, you know, the current materials and the science does have its limits. I think those will also open doors to understanding just more complexity in biology. I think materials also opens up doors for like, there are a lot of great drugs out there, but there's still a lot of off-target effects. There's all types of targeting issues. I mean, it's come a long way, but there's still, you know, a lot of smart people thinking about different delivery models, you know, cleaner models, cleaner delivery. And I think some of that is biology, and that's also like new types of like, you know, nanomaterials that are mimetics. They sort of like mimic underlying biology. And as we better understand that biology and physiology, be able to reduce, you know, immunogenicity and sort of off-target effects and things like that. But I do think some of it will come down to like computational power and being able to like be able to do these like super complex, you know, calculations. And so that's the data scientists and machine learning, AI people with the materials people.
As we wrap up this episode, we've got Enterprise Studio Culture Center. What are some initiatives or activities going on UVA, Charlottesville, that the local, especially biotech community, but entrepreneurial community should be aware of or you would like to make aware of?
So I just want to give a shout out to the Commonwealth Bio Accelerator. So I mentioned it earlier in the episode. So Nikki Hastings and her team, who've been running the Seville Biohub for the last few years, have just, they're growing and they've built something up at North Fork where people can come and actually like rent a bench for a year and be part of a great cohort, a great community of other founders with all kinds of great strategic support wrapped around them. So I would shout that one out and stay tuned over the next year. Both David and I will be doing our best to promote what's happening at the BioAccelerator, and there may be an event, I'm just saying, that the Coulter Center and the Enterprise Studio co-host with the Accelerator to continue to raise awareness and support that entity.
Yeah, and I think the Commonwealth, whether it's this accelerator, there's also, I think it's Build Back Better Medicines in Richmond, in that corridor. It's a little bit more pharmaceutical oriented. They have some pharmaceutical packaging companies and formulation companies in that area. And I think that's great for the Commonwealth. It's not too far of a drive from Charlottesville. I know that Sewell Biohub is also, Nikki's also involved with some of those initiatives. And then from a research standpoint, of course, there's the Manning Biotech Institute that broke ground last year, and we'll be bringing on a lot of new talent into this region. And I think I see that as just private philanthropy towards university research with the intent of, you know, impact to health, you know, and so the generosity of the Manning family, who have been, you know, funding translational programs at UVA for many years, you know. And I think that really just shows the potential for impact with all sorts of funding sources and also like partnerships between the university and the community. So yeah, those are some of the things. And I think the future is bright. Really excited.
It's so exciting what's happening in Charlottesville. This year is actually going to be my 10-year reunion for UVA. And some of you may be in the audience who know me. I was David and I, we tried a lot of different things, medical hackathons and trying to get student maker spaces for biotech and medical kind of concepts. And to see the progress in the region and the impact of some of these companies that, you know, that I remember were being just founded at the time that I was graduating or closely after, to see how the companies have grown and hired and brought talent to the region and hired local talent, and how some of the students either founded those companies or they were in the leadership teams, and now those companies are large and now they're leading these incredible technology companies. But also to see organizations like Sewell Biohub in the region putting on startup pitch nights and putting on biotech-focused events. It's just, it's really been an incredible transformation. And so it's exciting to see the impact that's already been made. And now to see additional investment, talent being brought in and kind of building that momentum. So for all of you who love biotech, Charlottesville is a very cool region. Roanoke and Richmond also have a lot going on in biotech. There's just this triangle forming over there, and really worth checking out some of these events. I want to make a shout out, Lisa, to your writing on Medium. I really loved going through your articles. You cover so many interesting topics and have so many ideas that both have that kind of practical component to it, like here's really how you might do something, but also you tackle things like mindsets, leadership, culture in healthcare and medicine and in research. And so it's really good from a perspective of kind of stimulating your thinking and figuring out your limitations. I want to specifically call out, I really loved reading The Responsibility of Great Science, Lessons from Oppenheimer. I'm going to now watch the movie as a result.
Please do watch the movie and then read it again.
I'm like so bad at keeping up with like what's in the theaters. So I was like, oh, what is this cool movie? I didn't even hear about it. But I wanted to read this excerpt to our listeners so they can go and check out many things based on their interests. But this is one of the pieces within this article. This is something that we must remember in any science we are developing for humanity. Ultimately, it is not ours. It belongs to the systems, the people who paid for its development, investors, the insurers that cover the costs, the physicians who make the decisions to prescribe it, and ultimately the patients who experience it. And lots of great reflection questions at the end to also see how that can apply. So that circles really well back to our original question on complexity in the healthcare system. And I just really recommend going through Lisa's writing and taking a good look at that.
Oh, thank you, Dasha. That's lovely.
Absolutely. And it is linked in the description. So you just follow the link.
Fantastic.
A couple quick announcements. We will be having a season 3 starting right after in March, right after this episode comes out. We're really excited to share that season 3 also received a grant from the Glenn W. Bailey Foundation to support ongoing production, as well as a little bit of expansion. We're going to be starting an Instagram channel, and you can learn while you scroll. And also, our next season has a really exciting theme, which we introduced a little bit in this episode, which is we're going to be thinking a little bit about how innovation happens at the bedside, how people who are maybe patients, doctors, nurses, therapists, how are they finding problems and tackling solving them? We have some great speakers already lined up who are going to be able to share their own stories. We're also opening up some sponsorship opportunities on our next season. So if you are interested in that, or you have some feedback to share, a guest to recommend, you want to be connected with a guest on the podcast or anything else, just reach out to us at biomedicalfrontiers@virginia.edu. And our Instagram channel too is Biomedical Frontiers. So see you guys in the next season. David, Lisa, thank you.
Thanks so much, Dasha.
Thank you, Dasha. Thank you for listening to Biomedical Frontiers, stories with innovators in healthcare. My name is David Chen, and I am the Managing Director of the Wallace H. Coulter Center for Translational Research at the University of Virginia. Our mission is to help bring promising new biomedical research and technology into the hands of the provider and the patient. If you found this episode valuable, please let us know by subscribing, following, or sharing. You can learn more about our promising translational research projects on our website. See links in the show notes.